thank you for coming, first of all. I'm absolutely amazed. And, if we did a lecture on Sunday afternoon in the States at 2 o'clock, there would be nobody there. So I was amazed when Rabbi Lilienthal suggested the time and the fact that that you have come to spend time with me, not knowing who I am or what I do or whether it's worth it or not. I hope I can make it worth it. I'm going to try my best. Rabbi Lilienthal said that I should introduce myself. Before I do that, I, of course, want to thank him and to thank the board of Crescas for the honor of speaking before you. We did this at the last minute. My hosts at the University of Amsterdam, Irene Zwepp and Shlomo Berger, told me that, you don't have to do much work. And I said, but I want to give. I give lectures in the community in the United States. Why can't I do it here? And finally, Rabbi Lilienthal picked up the ball, as we say, and arranged so that it would actually happen. So I'm really delighted. I also want to thank, what is that? Is that, I have to finish already? No?
You're over your time.
Okay.
More people
coming
to listen.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's the door. I see. Okay. I want to thank the University of Amsterdam for inviting me to your Gan Eden of Amsterdam. I told my wife on the phone, she was here, but she had to go back. She is a real estate agent, that I'm ready to make Aliyah if someone would invite me to Hamakom, or the Mokom. In fact, I could tell you another story. My mother unfortunately died 2 months ago. She was 92, so of course, I was very thankful for a long life. And I went to Jerusalem for the funeral. And before the Shiva was over, I was just overwhelmed. There's a tradition in Jerusalem of so many hundreds of people coming to visit you. And all my academic colleagues were there, and those I wanted to see and those I didn't want to see, and it went on and on. I couldn't take it. I finally said to them, I'm going back to Amsterdam because the Mokum Yenachemoti, if you understand what that means. And it did. I came back to the tranquility of the canals, and I felt much better. So I don't know if that was Lefi Halacha, but nevertheless, for me, it worked. Let me tell you a little about myself. I'm a Reform rabbi, although I don't make a living being a Reform rabbi. My father was also a Reform rabbi who made Aliyah and lived in Israel for 30 years. I just on the first day of Pesach, my daughter announced her engagement to a Reform rabbinical student whose father is a Reform rabbi. So although I try to get away from this heritage, I don't succeed. The tradition continues. But I would not necessarily call myself only a Reform rabbi. That is too restricting. I've always seen myself as an ecumenical Jew, very comfortable in many spaces. I've been saying Kaddish in the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue, sitting under the name of several of my heroes in the small winter shul. Since I study the 17th century, as you're going to hear in a second, it has been an extraordinary spiritual experience for me to be there, even though the synagogue, the community, is rather small and depleting. I was there this Shabbat, and I actually know the melodies, and I was, since it was so weak, I started singing really loud because I finally had the confidence to participate in the service, and that has been one of my great achievements of the 3 months that I've been here. I am a professor of Jewish history at the University of Pennsylvania, which has probably one of the finest programs in Jewish studies in the world. There are 20 faculty in residence. Plus, I direct the Center for Advanced Judaic Studies, which is a center for research on the highest level of Judaic studies in the world. We invite every year 20 scholars to the University of Pennsylvania. By the way, I hope I'm not speaking too fast English, right? I'm a New Yorker and I speak New York English, so you have to get used to it. If I speak too fast, just put your hand up and I'll slow down. This exciting institute meets throughout the entire year. I'm going back now for our final conference. We publish a book, a journal, and the renaissance of Jewish learning that goes on in the United States and in the world is really quite visible in places like Penn, and it is a very great privilege to be the director of this institute and also to be teaching Jewish history at the University of Pennsylvania. The other interesting thing, I mentioned I was a Reform rabbi, but most of my students are yeshiva kids. University of Pennsylvania attracts an enormous Orthodox Jewish population of kids from the best yeshivot in America. Remarkably, the university is a neutral, perhaps to use the word, parva place, where Jews and non-Jews and Jews of all denominations come together to study. It has been quite remarkable that 75% of my students are kids who graduated yeshiva, the best yeshivot in New York and elsewhere. And they study with me. I don't offend them usually, and they don't offend me, and we learn from each other. So that perhaps is one of the great promises of universities for the Jewish community as a resource for Jewish life. The other aspect that is important to me and is reflected in the center is our outreach program. You can't create a treasure of Jewish learning and not share it with the entire community. So I have a full-time assistant director who runs some 25 lectures in the greater Philadelphia community for the entire community, mini courses, mini series. We link up with synagogues in Los Angeles, in Westchester, in Dallas, and several other places where we send scholars every year to lecture. We are beginning this summer for the first time, rabbinic institutes, where rabbis of all denominations come and study with our scholars. And the scholars are of all denominations as well, from Yeshiva University, from JTS, from the Reform Movement. And we feel that educating rabbis is a way of stimulating the Jewish community. So I don't want to speak about this anymore, but I simply wanted to share with you a bit of the world that that I live in and am very proud to be a part of. All right, now our subject. I was kind of surprised that the powers to be chose this topic. I was trying to find some kind of kesher, connection between this and Yom HaShoah this evening. I could not. Except that you could say it was a Chorban at the end, that is too loose a connection to be meaningful whatsoever. But I do think it is a reflection of our time that contemporary Jews should be interested in such bizarre subjects as Shabtai Tzvi. And therefore, in the past, I might have tried to justify or apologize why so esoteric a topic. Now, in a world of messianisms, which seem to plague us every day, and radical messianic movements, both within Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, and more, perhaps we have a lesson to learn from this experience. Now, let me tell you, by way of beginning, if I were giving this lecture 15 years ago, it would have been relatively simple. There was primarily one narrative, and that narrative was of the greatest scholar of the 20th century in Judaic studies, of Gershon Scholem. I know some of you have read him and know who he is. If you haven't, you should be reading Scholem, begin with his major trends in Jewish mysticism. But he has a book called The Messianic Idea in Judaism and other essays on Jewish spirituality. And of course, his magnum opus, which is called Shabtai Tzvi, The Mystical Messiah, published by Princeton University Press. Big, fat book of over 1,000 pages, just on the first years of Shabtai Tzvi's life. In other words, it does not cover the movement of Shabtai Tzvi that follows, that I'm going to really speak about this afternoon. One grand narrative, and that would be it. And that would take me 20, 25 minutes to explain, and we'd be finished. But since Scholem died in the early 1980s, there has been a major questioning and assault on his grand reconstruction. And we now have several other reconstructions that make the subject even more confusing and bewildering. It is a bewildering subject to start with, but it's even more confusing by the way historians approach the subject from different angles and different ways of understanding. I would be probably not the first to tell you that historians often write their own autobiography. That is, that we look at the past through our own particular lens, so that every generation sees the past from its own perspective. And that is why you are here, not only to understand something about the past, but to understand something about the present and the world we live in. So that clearly part of this is a reflection of a different age, of a different stance. Perhaps we might even argue of the place of Zionism in Jewish culture today and differently as it was, let's say, 20 years ago or 25 years ago, since Sholem was also associated with the Zionist movement in a very direct sense, and you will see his Zionist understanding of these events, things have changed. And perhaps historians are simply creatures of the world they live in and reinterpret them. So my story, therefore, is rather complicated. Not only because the story is complicated, but because the historians who tell the story see it from different perspectives. So bear that in mind. Now let me begin with Sholem. For those of you who do not know his reconstruction well, we need to begin with what is really a grand story. You could argue that perhaps all of Sholem's writings on Kabbalah, the great student of the Kabbalah, of Jewish mysticism, were an afterthought after studying Shabtai Tzvi. Already in the early 30s, Sholem published an essay in Hebrew. How many of you know Hebrew? Few? Okay, yeah, no, not bad. I'll translate, of course, everything. An essay called HaMitzvah HaBa'a Be'Avira. Translation, a commandment that comes out of sin. That sounds pretty horrible. It was translated into English as the holiness of sin, in which he sketched out his argument about Shabtai Tzvi. The notion that a mitzvah is indeed an avirah, that a commandment is in fact the sin. By doing the sin, you are performing the commandments. In other words, the reversal of values, a transvaluation, so to speak. Or as Sholem used the word, and I first learned the word when I was a graduate student at the Hebrew University, where I did my doctorate in the 60s. I was reading at that time Gershon Sholem's volume in Hebrew, two volumes, and I came across a word, antinomianism. And I looked it up in every Hebrew dictionary, and I couldn't find it. And I discovered it was a word, an English word called antinomianism, which I then had to look up. And I realized antinomus, anti-law, that's what Sholem calls the Sabbatian movement, Shabtai Tzvi. So anyway, I learned an English word from Sholem as well in those days. But whether we use the word anarchic or antinomian or a negation of values, this was the essay that Sholem first wrote. So when he also discussed mysticism and messianism, he also had Shabtai Tzvi in mind. Perhaps his most famous reconstruction is the notion that messianism is inherent to Jewish tradition, but there are various versions of messianism. Now, he talks about three, but I'm going to sort of summarize it with two because it does the trick just as easily and makes it simpler. There are two kinds of messianism for Sholem. The first he calls conservative or restorative, and the second he calls utopian radical. The first is simply the vision which emerges already in the Tanakh, but certainly is developed by the rabbis, that when the Messiah comes, there will be kibbutz galiot, the ingathering of all of the exiles, the temple will be rebuilt, the sacrifices will be restored, and things will return to the way they were in the beginning. The assumption, of course, is that the normative structure of Judaism, that is the law, the rabbis, would remain intact. In fact, I always love to tell it this way. What is the messianic era for a rabbi? This works better probably for non-Orthodox, but maybe it works also for Orthodox, I don't know. A rabbi's vision of the Messiah would be that his Yom Kippur crowd would be also every Shabbat. In other words, everybody would be davening, everybody would be praying, everybody would be taking halakha seriously. Judaism would be that. What better ideal is there of a rabbinic messianic era? But that is only one idea of the Messiah, according to Sholem. There is another idea, which is rather ambiguous and perhaps not so clearly understood, but nevertheless also is there. It begins with these ridiculous metaphors of lambs lying down with lions, with all of the language of the prophets. What is that? Lambs lying down with lions? What's going on here? What kind of fabulous scenario are we talking about here? What happens in the end when the Messiah comes? Perhaps, God forbid, when the Messiah comes, we don't need Jewish law. We don't need halakha. And God forbid, especially, you don't need rabbis. Shh. Why do we need rabbis any longer? They can all retire. We have a perfect society. All of us are good and perfect. And therefore, there is a notion within the Jewish tradition, which is even framed by a word called Hilchata de Mashiacha, the halakha of the Messiah. What does that mean as opposed to the halakha of the pre-Messianic age? What happens when the Messiah comes? Do we need to go through these motions of being Jewish? All of us will be perfect, so what's the difference? Now that question, of course, the rabbis didn't want you to ask. In fact, they said in the Talmud, Tipach rucham shel michashvei kitzim, destroy those who think in terms of when the coming of the age and what's going to happen, etc., etc. Don't ask such questions. And even, and this was a text that Sholem explored really quite well, even in the Code of Jewish Law, written by the Rambam, Maimonides, in the 12th century, called the Mishneh Torah. At the end of the Mishneh Torah, there is a whole section, Hilchot Melachim. At the end of the 11th and the 12th chapter, there is a discussion of the Messiah. And here, the Rambam, Maimonides, speaks both as a philosopher, but I would say primarily as a rabbi. Don't get crazy. I'm not giving you the exact, I'm giving you my paraphrase, obviously. Don't get crazy. Don't read all this stuff. It's only metaphors. Don't take it seriously. Lambs don't lie down with lions. The only thing that will be different when the Messiah comes is there will no longer be she'ibud malchuyot. In other words, the nations of the world will not, hold us down, will not keep us in captivity. Otherwise, everything will be the same. Haolam kiminhago noheg. The world will continue as it did. In other words, halacha, rabbis, tradition, everything will be the same. Now we will have the optimal conditions for observing rabbinic law. Not that rabbinic law would go away. So here is the Maimonides already anticipating a group of crazies walking around saying the Messianic era means the end of us. In other words, to see it as a challenge to rabbinic authority. Already in Maimonides' day, of course, there were Messianic movements. In fact, there were a long history of Sephardic Messianic movements from the 6th and 7th century on, from the rise of Islam on, and even earlier. And in his own day, he had to address the issue regarding false messianic figures who he saw as being a danger to traditional Judaism. So Maimonides anticipated the problem. There is the traditional view of messianism, and there is this radical utopian view, which is unclear, and in its lack of clarity presents a potential danger to the Jewish people. Now, taking that story, Sholem, therefore, looks at the case of Shabtai Tzvi. And here are the salient facts as Sholem presents them. Born in Smyrna, which is now Izmir in Turkey. Remember that city because it has a great importance now, which you'll hear a little later on when we get to the revisionist view of Jewish history. A man who Sholem interprets, I have to be very careful here, I have a psychiatrist here, a manic depressive. I should add that more recently Moshe Idel has challenged the whole notion of manic depression and argued that indeed he suffered Shabtai Tzvi from a different psychological condition based on his name. What is Shabtai? In English, you know what it is? Or in Dutch, and anything? Anybody know? Shabtai is the planet Saturnus, Saturn. Right? Is that the way you say it in Dutch? How do you say Saturn in Dutch? All right, okay. And what is significant about Saturn in Western civilization? It is, first of all, a planet associated with the Jews, but more than that, it is associated with a disease which plays an important role in early modern culture called melancholia. Robert Burton wrote an entire enormous tract in the 17th century in which he describes melancholia. Melancholia is a disease suffered by poets and intellectuals, but also Jews have it. And in fact, it is a Jewish disease. And indeed, Shabtai, therefore, for Idel signifies the astrological context in which to understand a diseased soul, so to speak. Anyway, that's just a speculation, but it's a very interesting one that goes along with Sholem and manic depression. In any case, manic depression seems to be the way that is very easy to understand this rather bizarre personality. Grows up, moves on to Egypt. There he marries a woman and divorces her. He marries a Torah. I don't know if he divorces her. That was supposed to be funny, but I guess that didn't translate well in the English. In any case, then finally makes his way up towards the land of Israel, stopping off in Gaza. Seems rather bizarre that we should be talking about Gaza in this context. But there he meets a very important figure, perhaps the most important figure in the Sabbatean movement. Sabbatean movement means the movement of Shabtaut, or of Shabtai Tzvi. A man called Nathan of Gaza, or Natan HaAzati, who is, on the one hand, a political impresario. On the other hand, I'm knowing how to use his subject for whatever political purposes he wants. Also a major Kabbalist in his own right, and also clearly a kind of, you'll forgive the word, shrink, a psychiatrist, a kind of physician of the soul, being able to understand the temperaments of the personality of Shabtai that goes from high to low, from a kind of depressive, isolated state to being engaged in the world. And Nathan takes him under his wing, so to speak. They end up in Jerusalem in 1665-66. They declare Shabtai Tzvi the Messiah of Israel to save the world. Now, Shabtai, of course, is not the first messianic figure in this period, as we've said. Just a century earlier, there were two figures who were called the Messiah. One was David HaRuuveni. The other was Shlomo Molcho in the 16th century. Molcho is very interesting and relevant to our story because Molcho was a converso, a Marano, who converted in Portugal when he met Ruveni, publicly circumcised himself. That must have been quite a scenario. And then left to meet with the Pope, and finally was killed by the Inquisition. If you're in Prague, in the Prague Museum, you will see his red flag with all these messianic prophecies that are written on it. Absolutely amazing story of Molcho. Molcho is about 100 years earlier, in the beginning, in the early part of the 16th century. We're speaking now about 1666, so 100 years later. Now Shabtai Tzvi, of course, is immediately caught by the Ottoman officials. Notice the interesting parallels, by the way, to our story with Jesus. Jesus is also caught in Jerusalem for being a kind of rabble-rouser, you know, getting the moneylenders all upset and so on. And similarly, Shabtai Tzvi is causing a commotion and is caught by the officials. Brought to Turkey, imprisoned, and told in good American English to put up or shut up. That is, to either do your messianic thing or convert to Islam. Lo and behold, he converts to Islam. But the story is not over. Because at this point, many of the followers of Shabtai Tzvi, and apparently he had caused a commotion throughout the Jewish world, and I will come back to that point in several ways very shortly. After converting, of course, some people give up on him, but others remain believers in the messiahship of Shabtai Tzvi. Now, just following Sholem, just two more steps. I could really expand this even more, but let me do so in sequence rather than, let me just stay with Sholem at this point. This is Sholem's story. According to Sholem, after the conversion, it needed to be explained. The paradox of how a Messiah could convert to Islam. Similar to the paradox of how can a Jewish Messiah be crucified on a cross. In each case, the followers of the Messiah had to find some kind of rationale, some kind of justification for explaining it ideologically. In the case of Jesus, blaming the Jews and the resurrection are part of this ideological construction. In the case of Shabtai Tzvi, and here is Sholem's most telling point, The ideologues of the Sabbatian movement took an ideology that had become prominent in the 17th century, the ideology of the Kabbalist Isaac Luria, who had written, or who, in fact, who had spoken his ideology over 100 years earlier, what we call Lurianic Kabbalah. Now, I'm not going to try to explain to you Lurianic Kabbalah at this moment. If you're interested, it is the previous chapter to Shabtai Tzvi in Shalom's book, Messianic, his book on Jewish mysticism. There you can see how it works out. But basically, the idea is that the world has exploded. It is a mess. Evil has taken the good sparks of the universe, father and father, from its source. And what we need is a process called tikkun, or the restitution of divine sparks, the nitzutzot, as they're called in Hebrew, to remove them from the evil, which is called the klipa. The process of the Jew, then, is to bring about tikkun, to bring about restitution. And that becomes the ideology of Lurianic Kabbalah in the 16th century. According to Shalom, the Kabbalistic system spreads all over the world. The ideologues of Shabtai Tzvi take this idea and use it to explain the paradox of a Messiah converting to Islam. Why did he convert to Islam? Because he knew he had to descend to the realm of evil, to the klipa, in order to extract the nitzutz, the divine spark. In other words, he's sort of helping the process even more by going down to evil, that is Islam, wrestling with the evil. I'm not much of a mathematician, but minus times minus equals plus, right? The minus of going down to evil, the evil of converting to Islam equals plus. In other words, ultimately, the holiness of sin. What, by doing a sin, he is actually bringing about the good. That explains his paradoxical behavior. So therefore, what we have is an explanation, according to Lurianic Kabbalah, of why the Messiah went down to become a Muslim. But ultimately, he will reveal himself as the Messiah. This is only temporary. In other words, only on the surface do you see him as a Muslim. Internally, he is still the Jewish Messiah. Now, two responses are possible to this phenomenon on the part of his followers. And here is the last piece that I want to add about Shalom's reconstruction. There are moderate Sabbateans and radical ones. Moderate Sabbateans are those who believe that under the present circumstances, when the Messiah is a Muslim sitting in a Turkish jail, but has not revealed himself publicly, let us continue to do Judaism as we do Judaism, to practice Judaism faithfully. Although we know in our heart, a kera balev, a kind of ripping in the heart, that something has changed, that something radically has changed, and ultimately we will be doing something else. But in the meantime, let us continue to practice Judaism, at least externally on the surface, while we live with the internal secret that the Messiah is about to come. Those are the moderates. The radicals, of course, are of a different kind. For them, the Messiah is a source of emulation. That is, we will do as the Messiah does. The first group was a group founded by a man named Brachia, called the Donmeh in Turkey, who decided to convert to Islam in emulation of the Messiah himself. The story has been told and retold. Shalom found many documents of the Donmeh. The Donmeh are still identifiable in Turkey today, although they are not necessarily messianic anymore. But clearly there are such people that claim to come from this particular world. This group went underground. They were, of course, harassed by the Muslim authorities as well. If you've ever read Isaac Bashevis Singer, Satan and Gory, for example, or several other of his books, he was fascinated by this group because he thought they were doing sexual orgies and breaking the law and doing all kinds of horrible things. And since he was obsessed with sex in his novels, you'll see them having public sexual orgies and everything. If you want to read a fictional account of the Donmeh, it's all out there for you. In any case, the Donmeh were one group. But it becomes even more bizarre because as we enter the 18th century, another young man comes down from Poland, and there he meets with the Donmeh and believes he too is a Gilgul, a transmigration of the Messiah. through the Donmer from Shabtai Tzvi, and his name is Jacob Frank, F-R-A-N-K. And Jacob Frank returns to Warsaw, where he converts with 1,000 of his followers to Christianity, all in the name of the Messiah. And he writes a work in Polish, which is called The Words of the Master. It is a diabolical book. It is a book written by a fascist mentality. Fania Sholem, of all people, the wife of Gershon Sholem, translated the work from Polish into Hebrew. We don't have an English translation yet, even though several people have been working on it. It is a book about follow me step by step. Every time the rabbis say, do a commandment, break that commandment. Let there be blood in the street. We will kill anyone who observes the halakha, because you will follow me step by step, because I am the messianic figure. It is really quite a remarkable text to be written by a person connected to Jewish history. And it is very challenging for those who are studying this period in Jewish history for the first time. But nevertheless, Frank goes all the way. Frank is caught by the Inquisition. Because the Christians did not get a gift by getting these guys to convert. They got a Meshuggah group of people that were out to break the law, all kinds of laws. And what is interesting, and it becomes rather blurred throughout the 18th century, the story of Frankism is the story of religious unrest, of nihilism, of antinomianism, I use these words, and also political unrest. Many of the Frankists actually go become Polish revolutionaries. Gershon Sholem actually wrote an essay once in which he argued that some of the early Reform rabbinical families in Germany can trace their roots back to Frankism. Jacob Katz killed him in that article, and in a response saying that's not the case and that's a ridiculous argument. But nevertheless, it did open up the floodgates. And what we see in the 18th century, and now we have a remarkable young man named Pavel Manchenko, who is now at the Hebrew University, a Pole, who has been combing the archives in Poland to find all kinds of connections between Frankists, between those who converted to Christianity, who were living in a kind of liminal state between Judaism and Christianity, between groups like the Rosicrucians or the Swedenborgians or the Freemasons, all of these radical underground groups to have connections with the Frankists, not only in Poland, but throughout all of Europe. So what we are speaking about is a kind of radical underground which this mentality emerges into. And thus we are speaking about something which, as you will see, and this is of course a glimpse into the next part of my lecture, that has ramifications not only in the Jewish world, but beyond. All right, now that took a long time, but that is Gershon Sholem. And that is a remarkable story in itself. Notice the following, that Sholem's history is an intellectual history of ideas. From Lurianic Kabbalah to Sabbatianism, and if I was going to tell the rest of the story, I would show you how Sabbatianism is neutralized in the 18th century movement called Hasidism. There is a connection between all three. Okay? When I was reading Sholem in Hebrew, I came across the word linatrail. And I looked it up in my dictionary also, and I couldn't figure out what it was until I learned it was neutralization. It was an English word made into Hebrew as well. So that neutralization of the messianic idea is the way Sholem would interpret Hasidism. But I'm not going to talk about Hasidism today. That's another lecture. You have to invite me back for that one. In any case, now we come to the post-Sholem era. Okay, we are living in the post-Sholem era. Sholem's influence. So an intellectual history, an internal history. Notice this, Sholem knew all about the larger world of the 17th, 18th century. But it's not in this book. It's an internal story about Jews, about how Jewish ideas in one era influence other Jews. It is an internal Jewish story. And it is also a story which is dialectical. Lurianic Kabbalah, thesis. Sabbatianism, antithesis. Synthesis, Hasidism, all right? Very interesting, this kind of dialectical version of history, which was very characteristic of the way Sholem taught history. The question is this satisfactory as an explanation of our subject? Now, here I'm going to be very brief because I see I've been taking too much time and I can't go on forever here. But let me mention a few of Sholem's critics. two of the most famous scholars of Kabbalah and of Jewish mysticism in the 20th and 21st century are Moshe Idel, who I mentioned, I-D-E-L. By the way, he is going to be here this summer at a rather crazy conference I noticed at the University of Amsterdam on Kabbalah and the New World, spirituality and all kinds of, and a lot of strange people speaking there. But Idel is not strange. He's really quite a remarkable scholar and a very close friend. So if you want to catch him, he's going to have his Amsterdam appearance, I think, in July or August. Someone in the Religious Studies Department of the University of Amsterdam is organizing the conference. I know nothing about it. But I do know he's going to be there. And the other scholar is Yehuda Liebes, L-I-E-B-E-S. Moshe Idel and Yehuda Liebes, L-I-E-B-E-S. Liebes is less well known to people outside the field, but is certainly as significant as Idel. Idel writes most of his books in English. Liebes writes only in Hebrew. He's a very big Zionist who believes that scholars should only write in Hebrew. They are both profound scholars, and to my amazement, even though they are younger than me by a year or two, they are both retiring from the Hebrew University this year. So the young Turks are old Turks all of a sudden, and even retired Turks, which is really quite remarkable. And in fact, there are a group of young scholars who are attacking them as I speak. So the subject, as you see, goes on and on and on. That's the fun of doing history. Each generation sees the past, as I said, from a different perspective. For Idel, the most serious critic of Sholem, Luriana Kabbalah, first of all, I didn't say it earlier, Sholem saw as a reaction to the trauma of 1492, of the expulsion of Spain. For Idel, there was no connection. Also, Luriana Kabbalah did not spread. It was kept to a small, esoteric group of people. And therefore, the idea that it could be the seedbed for Sabbateanism doesn't make sense. In fact, now we know the opposite to be the case. And here I'm already giving you a very new idea that is extremely important. The printing press is a vehicle which changed Jewish culture in the 16th and 17th century in so many ways. I'm going to Berlin this week, and I'm going to be lecturing on that in the University of Potsdam. A very important subject. The way we study rabbinics, the way the Talmud was published, the way we study Tanakh with the Mikraot Gedolot, with the rabbinic Bible and so on. But also the diffusion of Kabbalistic texts. Kabbalah becomes an important cultural factor to a large number of people, Jews and Christians, because of the printing press. In fact, what is interesting is that Luriana Kabbalah becomes popular in the literature which we call Musar, or moral literature based on Lurianic ideas, through the Sabbatean printing press. In other words, the Sabbateans spread their word through print. That is a critical element in this story, how they move ideas from place to place because printing now reaches a large public, including Christians. And Christians take notice of Shabtai Tzvi. They write about Shabtai Tzvi. They react to Shabtai Tzvi. 1666 is a millennial date in the calendar of Christian millennialism. So there is clearly a direct connection, something that Sholem knew but he never chose to speak about. So clearly the notion that Luriana Kabbalah spread and then Shabtai Tzvi used it because it was popular is not necessarily the case. It's the opposite. Luriana Kabbalah became popular because of the Sabbateans who popularized it in their own generation. Moreover, for both Liebes and Idel, the political implications of this. See, Sholem saw this as a political movement. He saw this as challenging the authority of the rabbis, as we've seen, of actually challenging authority in general. For Liebes, Shabtai Tzvi is a more quiet individual, a more inward focused person. For him, what happens on the outside is not important. History, historical events don't mean anything because the real world in which mystics live in is this internal world. And therefore, to see it as a kind of political movement transforming Jewish culture is wrong. The last thing I should have added about Sholem is that this is the beginning of modern Jewish history. The internal revolt, not triggered by emancipation, not triggered by political events on the outside, but by an internal revolution of spirit. That is the beginning. The Sabbateans are the beginning of modern Jewish history. Perhaps the difference in tone between Idel and Liebes and Sholem has something to do I don't want to use the word because it'll be misinterpreted, post-Zionist or a different kind of Zionism that exists today. Sholem was part of a Zionist group of historians called the Jerusalem School. Yitzhak Baer, Gershon Sholem, Ben-Zion Dinur, most important. These were historians that shaped Jewish culture in terms of a Zionist narrative, that Jewish history is all about Aliyah, is all about land, is all about the focus upon land or absence of land, return to land, etc., etc. These new historians don't necessarily see it that way, and therefore their focus has changed. But that, of course, was Sholem's grandiose understanding, and their understanding is somewhat different. Now let me get to my own interpretation here, and here I want to expand the argument even wider. In other words, I could talk more about Libus and Idel, but I think that you really need to spend a lot of time on this, and we don't have the time, and I really want to get to the bottom line, the nitty-gritty, as we say. What is significant about this movement for Jewish history, and how should we understand it in our own day? If Sholem's narrative is lacking, and even the narrative of Idel and Libus can also be expanded upon. Now, I could go ahead and mention many other books. I'll mention two authors that I'm going to refer to, but a lot of this is my own as well as theirs. One is a young woman named Elisheva Karlbach, very interesting woman, professor at Queens College in New York, a Rebbetzin whose husband is a Rosh Yeshiva, and she writes on heresy. Very interesting. You might want to analyze her as well. But anyway, she's a fascinating woman, and she her first book was on this period, about one of the major rabbis to take on directly the Sabbateans, named Moshe Hajiz. In Pursuit of Heresy is the name of the book. She just wrote another book now on converts to Christianity from Judaism in the early modern period, which also is a subject that had been taboo to Jewish historians for many years. Nobody likes to speak about Mishum Adim, but in fact it is a very fascinating subject, and she has written a very interesting book as well. The other historian I want to speak about, also from the Orthodox Jewish community, is a historian named Matt Goldish, G-O-L-D-I-S-H, who has a book called, from Harvard University Press, The Sabbatean Prophets, which is a very new and fresh attempt to understand what we are speaking about. And he was a student of mine, and you'll see some of his ideas are also my ideas. What I want to do is to start now a little bit differently. 1666, you'll recall, is the date of Shabtai Tzvi. I'm going to give you another date now, and I will give you an A+ for any, if that means anything, in this for anyone who can tell me what happened in this date. But I want to argue that the two dates are very intimately related. The date is 1670. Any takers? No.
Disease in Germany?
No. Any others? That's two, three strikes, you're out. Yes?
I thought it was a war in Poland from the Swedish and the Russians.
You might be right, but that's not what I'm thinking of. Yes?
They start building the Portuguese synagogue.
Ah, you would say something like that. It's next door to your place. All right.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, 1670, but also something else happened in Amsterdam. Yeah. The Theological Political Treatise was published by Spinoza, okay? That's what I was referring to. In other words, what I want to do is to make a connection between Spinoza and Shabtai Tzvi. Okay? Now, what is the connection? The first connection is a connection which Sholem talked about at length as well. That some of the most enthusiastic supporters of Shabtai Tzvi were conversos. Moranos. That is, Spanish and Portuguese who had been living as Christians, who were victimized by the Inquisition in Spain and Portugal throughout the 16th century. When Spain and Portugal were united in 1580, and when the Netherlands declared its independence, they escaped. And they came, of course, to Amsterdam. And they came to Livorno and Pisa in Italy, where they established a special political arrangement with the authorities. And they eventually came to the Ottoman Empire. And a few came to Ashkenaz. And many more came to Hamburg, where they established there a very powerful Sephardic Jewish community. And they returned to Jewish life. Within the 17th century, when Shabtai Tzvi appears, in the midst of this process of the converts, of the conversos, returning to the Jewish world, many were infatuated by Messianism. Not only types like Menashe ben Israel in Amsterdam itself, and I assume when I talk about Amsterdam Jewish history, I'm talking to people that know a lot. Maybe I'm wrong, but I assume. I have to assume here. But Menashe ben Israel, of course, wasn't a Sabbatean. But nevertheless, there was a large cell of conversos in Amsterdam who were followers of Shabtai Tzvi. There was also a large cell in Hamburg, Passau, New Amsterdam, Brazil, etc., etc. In other words, where the international economic networks of the conversos went, also Sabbatean ideas followed. And what is most interesting, discovered recently by a Jewish historian at Haifa University named Yaakov Barnai, one of the largest cells of Sabbateans, conversos, was Smyrna, in Smyrna. Smyrna was a major port for Murano merchants who came to the Ottoman Empire and who were in direct contact with Amsterdam and with Hamburg and with the rest of the converso diaspora. So one obvious connection is the converso connection. That is, the followers of Shabtai Tzvi were conversos. The two main ideologues of the Sabbatean movement were Natan HaZati, who we've already mentioned, Nathan of Gaza, who, as far as we know, was not a converso, but knew a lot about Christian theology, as is evident by his remarkable intellectual work. Avraham El-Kayam, who was a student of Yehuda Libous, wrote a 1,000-page dissertation on the theology of Natan HaZati, which shows to what degree this man knew about Christianity and about Islam and about the larger cultural world in which he lived in. And the second important ideologue was Avraham Cardoza, a converso. In fact, the story of Abraham Cardoza, we have several books written on him, is remarkably told by the historian of Columbia University, Yosef Yerushalmi, in a book about his brother, Isaac Cardoza, the story of a converso who returns from Spain and Portugal and becomes a Jew in Verona, in the ghetto of Verona in Italy in the 17th century. Isaac becomes a good Jew. But his brother becomes a follower of Shabtai Tzvi and indeed the major ideologue of two of the Sabbatean movement. And in a series of letters between Isaac and Abraham, we have this remarkable correspondence where Isaac says to Abraham, "What the hell are you doing? Why are you believing in this Messiah? It's almost like you're believing in Jesus." And he said, "If that's what it sounds like, maybe that's it is. He is indeed a man who is deified." In other words, he's made Shabtai Tzvi into a kind of Christian messianic figure. In other words, these individuals coming from a Christian background, renouncing their Christianity, nevertheless holding on to vestiges of their original self. Or to put it mildly, they still had a Christian cup, so to speak. They still thought in Christian terms, at least in messianic terms. So here we have this commingling of two religions. Notice what Sabbateanism is asking of its followers. In order to fulfill yourself in order for the Messiah to come, Judaism needs to be fulfilled through Islam or through Christianity. What kind of messianic idea is that? The three religions are connected here, and here one connecting link are the conversos. Of course, Spinoza grew up in a converso family in Amsterdam, was a student at Eitz Chaim, as you know, and of course left it all in his radical departure in his theological political treatise. His challenge to Judaism, of course, was a rational challenge. His argument was that God is in nature, but moreover, the biblical text is not a supernatural work. It needs to be understood in its natural sense. The biblical text does not have the truth for us. We can obtain the truth through our own philosophical autonomy. And therefore, he creates ultimately a religious experience which is post-Jewish, post-Christian, which is really part of a new secular liberal ideology which transforms, of course, the intellectual world of Europe in the 17th century. If you're not convinced of that argument, take a look at the massive volumes of Jonathan Israel, the great historian of Amsterdam, who has written two volumes on the radical enlightenment. The first volume is only about Spinoza and Spinozism and its impact upon the larger cultural space of the 17th century. So what does the crisis of Spinozism have to do with the crisis of Shabtai Tzvi? Is there any link whatsoever? One link, as we said, is the conversos. But here now, I'm now in the you'll forgive the baseball analogy here. Do you know what American baseball is at all? I don't know if it even works. But we're now in the seventh inning. There are nine innings in a baseball game, and we're now moving, you know, towards the end. So if you think I'm speaking too long, I'm getting there. I'm getting now close to the end. I want to talk about one more thing before I close this lecture, and that is the history of Sabbatianism in the 18th century. Because the story that I'm telling doesn't only begin in 1666 and die. It lasts well through the following century and a half, and even into the 19th century. And here I want to make a very telling point about what happens, what is the meaning of this entire movement. I want to describe what is described by Elisheva Karlbach in her book called In Pursuit of Heresy, three episodes of debate which inflict the Jewish community in very, very serious ways throughout the 18th century. These are the great debates, the great disputations, the great conflicts between Jews that exist in the 18th century. I won't describe them in great detail, but let me mention them. The first is the story of Nechemia Chayon, H-A-Y-O-N. He was a disciple of Abraham Cardoza. In the early part of the 18th century, he published a work called Oz LeElohim. He published it in Berlin, but the book was debated in Amsterdam between the various rabbis. Oz LeElohim means strength to God. It is a book where he is accused of being a follower of Shabtai Tzvi, although Shabtai Tzvi does not appear in the book. Rather, what appears is this mystic's attempt to explain to the world in print what is God. God is threefold, three dimensions. It sounds like Christianity. It's not, but it sounds like Christianity. The Christians were fascinated with this book. Here is a Jew who has found the truth through Kabbalistic sources, the truth, of course, of the Trinity. The book was scandalized. The book was a scandal. Clearly, who is this person telling us the secrets of God, publishing a book, talking about a book which with God is a kind of Trinity? Let us ostracize him. We have over 140 rabbis who write a cherem against, who publish a letter against this man. What is interesting here is the emergence of a transnational movement against Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi, through the press, disseminated its teachings throughout all of Europe, from the Ottoman Empire all the way to Amsterdam. At the same time, what emerges is a counter movement. What I would call the beginnings of orthodoxy. Orthodoxy as defined as a response to a modern threat to traditional Judaism. Orthodoxy as an organized attempt on the part of the rabbis to save themselves. In the 18th century, there is one title that appears over and over again in books published in the 18th century. It is called Emunat Chachamim. Translation? The faith of the Chachamim, the wise men, the rabbis, or something. Or could it be Emunah b'Chachamim? In other words, what I'm trying to say is that these books were attempt to defend the faithful, to defend the rabbis, to defend the rabbinical establishment. What is going on here is a threat which Nechemia Chayon poses. It is not so much about Shabtai Tzvi per se, it is about the notion of anyone picking up a book, publishing it, and saying, I can say anything I want, I can tell you what God is all about, you don't need those rabbis over there, anybody can do it. All of a sudden, knowledge need not be controlled by the rabbis, anyone has the possibility of saying and doing what he wants to do. Perhaps it is now time to define what kind of person I'm speaking about. The word that is used in the 18th century to describe these types, not only in the Jewish world, but in the Christian world, in the Muslim world, are enthusiasts or enthusiasm. An enthusiast is a person who, on the basis of his own personal autonomy, on the basis of his own knowledge, on the basis of his own spirit, on the basis of his own mystical ecstasy, whatever it may be, knows the truth, doesn't need the truth from rabbis or from priests or from political figures or from any establishment. He knows through the basis of his own individuality what is the truth. And now, given the printing press, he can put his ideas out for everyone to see. The second controversy is also a very famous controversy, which I'm sure some of you have heard of before. It involves two of the greatest rabbis in the Hamburg-Altona area, Yaakov Emden and Jonathan Eibeschitz. If you ever get in, if you visit the Hamburg and you're walking for some strange reason in the Ripper zone, the sex zone in Hamburg, I don't know why you want to go there, you have enough here. There is a major cemetery. The Sephardic cemetery is right there. Death and sex are together. It's really quite remarkable. There you will see also the extension, which is the Ashkenazic cemetery. And there you will see Yaakov Emden and Eibeschitz buried next to each other having a friendly conversation. It's absolutely unbelievable because these people they hated each other. They threatened each other. Their followers were at war with each other. They put each other in cherem and excommunication. Eibeschitz was accused of being a Sabbatean. In fact, he had some kind of Christian overtones. Emden was a crusader. He was part of that Orthodox group of Hasidim, but he himself was Meshugana. He published a work called Megillat Sefer, which one scholar has been trying to publish for many years, but I think is afraid to publish because it is a book, it is an autobiography filled with strange sexual dreams and all kinds of things that you wouldn't want to put out and that a rabbi shouldn't be writing, but is great for a psychiatrist to read. In any case, Emden was a very complicated figure. He was the son of Tzvi Ashkenazi, also the Ashkenazic rabbi of Amsterdam. So there is a long history here which connects this place to him as well. Emden and Eibeschitz are fighting over an issue whether there was an amulet which Eibeschitz made which made him Sabbatean or not. This story is not so much about Sabbateanism. It is about a rabbinic struggle for power. And clearly that's what seems to be at the core of this remarkable debate, which involves so many people, which involves so many pens. Finally, the last controversy is the controversy about another very famous and individual rabbi of the 18th century named the Ramchal, or Rabbi Moses Chaim Luzzatto, Italian rabbi from Padua, who had a circle of his disciples who would perform a kind of seance where he would make them into prophets. He would have a kind of prophetic seance. He was accused also of having messianic pretensions and of being a prophet. He had a lot of trouble publishing his books, but of course today he is revered. You can get all of his volumes if you go to Mea Shearim in Jerusalem and purchase them. A lot of people read the Ramchal these days. A very fascinating, enigmatic figure who also wrote some of the early plays of Hebrew, and he was associated with the beginning of modern Hebrew literature, ironically and paradoxically. What do these three controversies have to do with Shabtai Tzvi? And the answer is not really that much, except that Sabbateanism becomes, I would argue, a tag for anyone who is a dissenter, anyone who is an enthusiast, anyone who is challenging the rabbinic establishment, anyone who was using the printing press to put his ideas out there that would challenge the very existence of traditional Judaism and specifically the rabbis. This was the great crisis of Judaism in the 18th century. It was a crisis of enthusiasm from two sides, the messianic side and also the rational side. What is the connection between Shabtai Tzvi and Spinoza? They were both enthusiasts. They were both challenging the establishment of Judaism based on their own autonomy, on what they believed to be right in terms of their own individuality in defining what religion is and what they want to believe. And clearly, the rabbis saw this challenge as being extremely dangerous, critically dangerous to their future and to the viability of a traditional Jewish community. And they thus created a counteroffensive, an attempt to somehow fight back with very strong, powerful figures like Moshe Chagiz, like Yaakov Sasportis, Yaakov Emden. These were the great rabbis of the 18th century that attempted to present Judaism from their authoritative perspective. So we have taken Shabtai Tzvi now a long way. what I want to argue in closing this lecture is that, as Matt Goldish has argued in the book that I mentioned earlier, you can't understand this crisis only as an internal Jewish story. The 18th century in Europe was also a time of great crisis, of enthusiasm and anti-enthusiasm. In other words, of establishment figures being challenged by all kinds of radical movements that were affecting the future of Christianity and even Islam in the 18th century. In other words, the story we are telling here has deep parallels and connections with the other religions. You can't see Sabbatianism as only an internal story simply by the fact that the Sabbateans convert to Christianity or to Islam. So it is a story that involves all three religions. But it is much larger than that. It seems to me it is about a crisis of authority, which had been brewing for centuries earlier, but now really comes to a head. Of course, now with the Enlightenment to follow, and the emancipation, and the new challenges which Jewish life would experience in the 19th and the 20th century, these challenges would be exacerbated even more. But clearly, already by the late 17th and early 18th century, Sabbatianism had really changed the Jewish map, and it created new challenges to the viability of Jewish life that had never existed before. In this sense, Sholom is right. I would argue that modern Jewish history does begin more or less in this period, not only because of the Sabbateans, but also because of the conversos. The conversos offered a new challenge to Jewish life, in that they were, and here is the same notion that I've been speaking of up to now, they were choosing Jews, or Jews by choice, as we often use that expression today. That is, the conversos returned to the synagogue here in Amsterdam, and some of them, a small group, went to shul. Some of them went to do business at the shul. Some of them stayed outside the shul. Some of them never went to shul whatsoever, the majority. In other words, to them, to be a Jew was an ethnic identity. It wasn't necessarily a religious identity. Or maybe they were Yom Kippur or Rosh Hashanah Jews. They showed up once or twice a year. In other words, for them, to choose Judaism was not to be defined by the rabbinate, but by how I want to choose to be called a Jew. Whether it's ethnic, whether it's religious, whether it means a kind of syncretism between Judaism and Christianity. Take, for example, and I have not yet seen the cemetery here. I was going to be taken this morning by Shlomo Berger, but he canceled on me, so I'm going to leave Amsterdam without seeing the cemetery. But my next trip, I'll come back. But I have seen the cemetery in Hamburg that I mentioned. There you will see converso graves with crosses and mug and doves on the same grave. They were protecting two possibilities here. If they didn't make it one way, they would make it in the other way. In other words, what we're speaking about are people who are living betwixt and between what I would call mingled identities, mingled between Judaism and Christianity. In other words, that was also a threat to the rabbinate. In other words, the conversos were in some respects the first modern Jews, in that they were choosing how they defined what Judaism was. They lived outside what the Catholic Church told them about Catholicism, or what the synagogue and the rabbis told them about Judaism. They chose to be Jews as they saw fit. And some of them, as we saw, became followers of Shabtai Tzvi, because for them, that was the most exciting expression of their identity as Jews. New Jews. So how do I bring this to a close? I guess the question is, what does this have to do with us? I guess the answer is that Messianism ultimately is not simply about whether the Messiah comes from Brooklyn from Gaza and or from Samaria and or from someplace else, or who the Messiah is. Messianism is a very interesting phenomenon in Jewish history. It is neither good nor bad. It depends on who's using it for whatever purpose. That notion of Messianism, of course, of uplifting, of what I like to call, when I describe Jews, the kvetch mentality. You know what I mean by the kvetch mentality? I mean that we're never satisfied. You know, we always have to make the world better. We always want our children to be better off than we are. That has very deeply ingrained psychological notion within Judaism, and I think that comes from the Messianic idea in part, that, you know, the status quo is never totally perfect. we can make it better, and that's where we have to go. And that's, now that's a very positive and uplifting idea. You know, Hashanah Haba B'Yerushalayim, as we just recently said. Meaning not only being in Jerusalem, but actually building the perfect Jerusalem, the perfect society, etc., etc. At the same time, Messianism gets us into a lot of trouble. It creates all kinds, it attracts all kinds of sick people. It often radicalizes the very nature of Judaism, and it undermines norms and rabbinic authority, as the case of Sabbateeism did in the 17th century. One of Sholem's last interviews, which was in the New York Review of Books by David Beale, Sholem was a German Jew who lived in Rehavia and was